Hachette Audio presents Beyond the Ice Limit. Written by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Read by David W. Collins. Dedication to Jamie Rabb. Chapter 1. Gideon Crewe stared at Eli Glynn. The man was standing in the kitchen of Gideon's cabin, high in the Hemez Mountains, gazing at him with placid gray eyes. His all-terrain wheelchair, the wheelchair in which Glynn had always sat, virtually helpless since Gideon had first met him several months before, sat unused ever since he had, to Gideon's great astonishment, risen out of it minutes before. Glynn gestured toward the wheelchair. "Forgive this tiny bit of drama. I staged it, however, for an important reason, to show you that our mission to the Lost Island, despite certain regrettable aspects, was not in vain. Quite the opposite. I'm living proof of its success." A silence ensued. It stretched into a minute, 2 minutes. Finally, Gideon went to the stove, picked up the sauté pan containing the wild goose breast in a ginger and black truffle emulsion that he had just finished preparing with exquisite care, and dumped it into the garbage. Without a word, Glynn turned and walked, a little unsteadily, toward the cabin door, using a hiking pole as a brace. Manuel Garza, chief of operations at Glynn's firm, Effective Engineering Solutions, offered to help Glynn into the wheelchair, but Glynn waved this away. Gideon watched the two men leave the cabin, Garza guiding the empty wheelchair, the words Glynn had spoken a few minutes earlier reverberating in his mind. "That thing is growing again. We must destroy it. The time to act is now." Gideon grabbed his coat and followed. The helicopter that had brought the EES men to this remote site was still powered up, its rotors whistling, sending ripples of waves through the meadow grass. He followed Glynn inside the chopper and took a seat, buckling in and donning a headset. The chopper rose into the blue New Mexico sky and headed southeast. Gideon watched his cabin get smaller and smaller, until it was nothing more than a dot in a meadow, in a great bowl of mountains. Suddenly, he had a strange feeling he would never see it again. He turned to Glynn and spoke at last. "So you can walk again. And your bad eye, can you see with it now?"
"Yes."
Glynn raised his left hand, formerly a twisted claw, and flexed his fingers slowly. "Every day they get better. As does my ability to walk without aid. Thanks to the healing power of the plant we discovered on the island, I can now complete my life's work." Gideon didn't need to ask about the plant, nor did he need to ask about Glynn's life's work. He already knew the answers to both questions. "There is no time to waste. We have the money, we have the ship, and we have the equipment." Gideon nodded. "But before we take you back to EES headquarters, we have to make a little detour. There's something you must see. I regret to say it will not be pleasant."
"What is it?"
"I'd rather not say more." Gideon sat back, mildly irritated. Typical, inscrutable, enigmatic Glynn. He glanced at Garza and found the man to be as unreadable as his boss.
"Can you at least tell me where we're going?"
"Certainly. We're going to pick up the EES jet in Santa Fe and fly to San Jose. From there, we'll take a private car into the hills above Santa Cruz and pay a call on a gentleman who resides there."
"Sounds mysterious."
"I don't intend to be enigmatic."
"Of course you do."
A small smile, very small. "You know me too well. But since you do, you also know everything I do is with a purpose." The chopper left the mountains behind. Gideon could see the shining ribbon of the Rio Grande crawling through White Rock Canyon below them, and beyond that, the hills of the Caja del Rio. The town of Santa Fe spread out to his left.
As they proceeded over the southern end of town, the airport came into view.
"Let's talk about your final project," said Gideon. "You mentioned an alien, a seed. You say it's threatening the Earth?
That's all pretty vague. How about giving me the details, starting with why exactly you need my help?"
"All in good time," said Glenn.
"After our little excursion to Santa Cruz."
Chapter 2. A Lincoln Navigator, driven by an elfin man in a green cap, met them at the San Jose airport. From there, they had driven south along Route 17 into redwood-clad hills. It was a beautiful drive through towering, haunted forests. Both Glynn and Garza stayed resolutely silent. Gideon sensed they were ill at ease. Deep in the redwoods, the car turned off the highway and began winding its way along a series of valleys, past small farms and ranches, isolated villages, shabby trailers and run-down cabins, through deep pockets of redwoods, meadows, and burbling creeks. The narrow, cracked asphalt road gave way to gravel. The evening was advancing and dark clouds tumbled in, casting a pall over the landscape.
"I think we just passed the Bates Motel," said Gideon, with a nervous laugh. No one else seemed amused. He sensed a gathering atmosphere of tension in the car.
The gravel road entered another redwood forest, and almost immediately they came to a large, wrought-iron gate, set into a high stone wall. A wooden sign, once elegantly painted and gilded, but now somewhat faded, read, "Dearborn Park." Below that, an ugly utilitarian placard had been bolted. "No trespassing. Violators will be prosecuted with the utmost rigor of the law." As they approached, the gate opened automatically. They passed through and halted at a small gatehouse. The driver in the green cap rolled down his window and spoke to a man who came out. He quickly waved them along. The road, winding through gloomy redwoods, rose ahead. It began to rain, fat drops spattering on the car windshield. Now the feeling in the car was one of oppression. The driver turned on the wipers, which slapped back and forth, in a monotonous cadence. The SUV climbed to the ridgeline, and suddenly the redwoods gave way to a high meadow, many acres in extent. Through the sweeping rain, Gideon thought he glimpsed a distant view of the Pacific Ocean. At the far end, the meadow rose to a high lawn, at the apex of which stood a mansion of gray limestone in neo-Gothic style, streaked with damp. Four towers rose to crenellated turrets and battlements framing a grand central hall, its Gothic arched windows glowing dull yellow in the stormy twilight. They approached the mansion along a curving drive, wheels crunching the gravel. The wind picked up, lashing rain against the windshield. There was a distant flicker of lightning, and a few moments later, Gideon heard the delayed rumble of thunder. Gideon swallowed a crack about the Adams family as the driver halted under a pillared porte cochere. A red-haired orderly in a white jacket waited on the steps, brawny arms crossed, as they emerged from the vehicle. No one came forward to greet them. The orderly made a brusque gesture for them to follow and turned, walking back up the stone steps. They followed him into the great hall that served as the entryway. It was spare, almost empty, and their footfalls echoed in the large space as the door boomed shut behind them, slammed by an unseen hand. The orderly pivoted to the right, passed beneath an arched portal, then continued down a long hallway and into a parlor. At the far end stood a carved oaken door, on which the orderly knocked. A voice summoned them in. It was a small, comfortable office. A gray-haired man with a broad, kindly face, wearing a tweed jacket with leather elbow patches, rose from behind a desk. The walls were covered with bookshelves. A fireplace stood against the far wall, logs ablaze.
"Welcome, Mr. Glynn," he said, coming from around the desk, hand extended. "Mr. Garza?"
They shook hands. And you must be Dr. Crewe. Welcome. I am Dr. Hassenflug. Please sit down.
He accompanied this with a gesture indicating the chairs in which they were to sit, arrayed comfortably around the fire. His easy warmth contrasted strongly with the unease that surrounded Garza and Glynn. A brief silence ensued. Dr. Hassenflug finally broke the ice.
I imagine you wish to hear how the patient is doing?
I'm afraid the news is not encouraging. Glynn clasped his hands and leaned forward.
Thank you, but we're not here to learn about the patient's condition. As we discussed, our only purpose today is to see the patient. His prognosis is not our concern.
Hassenflug sat back.
I understand, but a word of caution might be in order.
I'm afraid any such word would be out of order.
The doctor fell silent, a frown gathering on his face. Much of his amiable air was dissipating under Glynn's curt and unfriendly tone.
Very well, then.
He turned to the orderly, who had been standing behind them, his hands clasped in front of his white jacket.
Ronald, is the patient ready to receive visitors?
As ready as he'll ever be, Doctor.
Please show the visitors into his quarters. You and Morris remain close by.
Hassenflug turned back to Glynn.
If the patient becomes excited, the visit may have to be terminated. Ronald and Morris will be the judges of that.
Understood.
They crossed the parlor and great hall, passing beneath another arch into what had once apparently been a large reception room. At the far end was a door, not of wood, but of riveted steel, and toward this door they headed. The orderly named Ronald paused before it, pressing a small intercom button.
Yes?
Came a tinny voice.
Mr. Lloyd's visitors are here.
The buzzer sounded and the door opened with a click to reveal a long, elegant marble corridor lined with ancestral portraits. There was nothing of the air of an institution about this place, although it was now clear to Gideon that it was, in fact, just that. The corridor gave onto an elegant room, ablaze with light. The room was furnished with dark Victorian sofas and armchairs, the walls covered with Hudson River School paintings of mountains, rivers, and other wilderness scenes. But what attracted Gideon's attention most strongly was the robust man, about 70 years old, with a shock of white hair, seated on one of the sofas. He was wearing a straitjacket. An orderly, Gideon assumed this was Morris, sat next to him with a tray on which sat an array of dishes, each holding a mound of pureed food. The orderly was spooning dark brown goop into the man's mouth. Gideon noticed that a bottle of red wine sat on the tray, a Chateau Petrus, no less. A plastic sippy cup filled with the wine stood adjacent to the bottle.
Your visitors are here, Mr. Lloyd, Ronald announced.
The man named Lloyd raised his massive, shaggy head, and two piercingly blue eyes widened at Glynn. Despite the straitjacket and the man's age, he still radiated strength and physical power. Slowly, slowly, the man stood up, staring at them and seeming to swell with a singular intensity. And now Gideon could see that his legs were cuffed and hobbled, rendering him unable to walk except in the tiniest of steps. He leaned over and spat out the brown stuff that the orderly had just put in his mouth.
Glynn.
He ejaculated the name the same way he had the puree.
And Manuel Garza. What a pleasure.
His tone indicated it was no pleasure at all. His voice was strange, quavering and deep, shot through with gravel. It was the voice of a madman. And now those concentrated blue eyes settled on Gideon.
And you've brought a friend?
This is Dr. Gideon Crewe, my associate, said Glynn.
The air of tension had gone off the charts. Lloyd turned to the orderly.
A friend? How surprising.
He turned back to Glynn.
I want to look at you. Up close. I'm sorry, Mr. Lloyd, said Glynn, but you have to remain where you are.
Then you come to me, if you have the guts.
I don't think that's advisable, Ronald began.
Glynn approached Lloyd. The orderly stiffened, but did not intervene. He halted about 5 feet away.
Closer, Lloyd growled.
Glynn took another step, then another.
Closer, he repeated. I want to look into your eyes.
Glynn walked forward until his face was only inches from Lloyd. The white-haired man stared at him for a long time. The orderly shifted nervously and remained close, tensing, it seemed, for whatever might happen.
Good. Now you can step back, please.
Glynn complied.
Why are you here?
We're mounting an expedition. To the South Atlantic. The ice limit. We're going to take care of the problem down there once and for all.
Do you have money?
Yes.
So you're not only criminally reckless, you're an idiot as well.
A silence. Lloyd continued.
It was 5 years and 2 months ago when I said to you, when I begged you, when I ordered you to pull the dead man's switch. And you crazy, obsessed son of a bitch, you refused. How many died? 108. Not counting the poor bastards on the Almirante Ramirez. Blood on your hands, Glynn.
Glynn spoke in a calm, neutral tone.
There's nothing you can accuse me of that I haven't done the same 100 times myself.
Cry me a river. You want agony? Look at me! For the love of God Almighty, I wish I'd gone down with the ship.
Is that why the straitjacket? Glynn asked.
I'm as gentle as a kitten. They've got me in this to keep me alive, against my will. Free one hand and give me just 10 seconds and I'm a dead man. A free man. But no, they're keeping me alive and burning through my own money to do it. Look at my dinner. Filet mignon, potatoes au gratin with Gruyere, lightly grilled cavallini di Bruxelles, pureed, of course, so I won't attempt suicide by choking. And all washed down with a 2,000 petrus. Care to join me?
Glynn said nothing.
And now here you are.
Yes. Here I am. Not to apologize, because I know no apology would be adequate or accepted.
You should have killed it when you had the chance. Now it's too late. You've done nothing while the alien has grown, swollen, and engorged itself.
Mr. Lloyd, said Morris, remember your promise not to talk any more about aliens.
Glynn, did you hear that? I'm forbidden to talk about aliens. They've spent years trying to rid me of my psychotic talk of aliens.
Glynn said nothing.
So, what's your plan?
Said Lloyd, recovering himself.
We're going to destroy it.
Excuse me, said Morris, but we're not to encourage the patient in his delusions.
Glynn silenced him with an impatient gesture.
Destroy it! Brave talk! You can't. You'll fail, just like you failed 5 years ago.
A pause.
Is MacFarlane going?
Now it was Glynn's turn to pause.
Dr. MacFarlane has not done well in recent years, and it seemed imprudent.
Not done well? Not done well! Have you done well in recent years? Have I?
Lloyd cackled mirthlessly.
So, instead of Sam, you'll take others with you, including this poor sap, what's his name, Gideon. You'll send them to a hell of your own making, because you've no sense of your own bloody weakness. You figure everyone else out, but you're blind to your own arrogance and stupidity.
He fell silent, breathing hard, the sweat coursing down his face.
Mr. Glynn, warned Ronald, the patient is not allowed to become excited.
Lloyd turned to him, suddenly calm, the voice of reason.
As you can see, Ronald, I'm not the least bit excited.
The orderly shifted, uncertainly. I'm not here to justify myself to you, said Glynn, quietly. I deserve all of this and more, and I'm not here to ask you to excuse my actions.
Then why are you here, you son of a bitch?
Lloyd suddenly roared, spraying spittle and brown flecks of pureed filet mignon into Glynn's face.
That's enough, said Ronald. Visit's over. You have to leave now.
Glynn removed his handkerchief, carefully wiped his face clean, and spoke quietly.
I'm here to seek your approval.
You might as well ask if the lamppost approves of the dog pissing on it. I disapprove. You're an idiot if you think you can still destroy what has grown down there. But you always were an arrogant, shit-eating grifter. You want my advice?
That's enough,
said Ronald, moving in and taking Glynn by the arm, directing him toward the door.
Yes, I want your advice, Glynn said over his shoulder.
As Gideon followed the orderly, who was gently but firmly escorting Glynn from the room, he heard Lloyd hiss out,
Let sleeping aliens lie.
Chapter 3. Back at EES headquarters, on Little West 12th Street, in the boardroom high above the old meatpacking district of New York City, Gideon took his place at the conference room table. There were only three of them, Garza, Glynn, and himself, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Glynn, having apparently dispensed with the need for sleep, seemed to expect his employees to do so as well. Gideon had begun to wonder if Glynn really had changed. He had never seen the man quite so driven, in his own quietly intense way. The meeting with Lloyd in the gigantic one-man mental hospital had evidently shaken him badly. The man serving them all coffee silently retreated, shutting the door behind him. The room was dim, the lights low. Glynn, seated at the head of the table, his hands clasped in front of him, allowed the silence to gather before speaking. He turned his two gray eyes on Gideon.
Well, what did you think of our visit to Palmer Lloyd?
He freaked me out, said Gideon.
Do you know now why I wanted you to meet him?
As you said, to seek his approval, get his blessing. After all, that thing down there cost him a lot of money, not to mention his sanity.
That's part of it. I also wanted to, as you put it, freak you out. To impress on you the gravity of our undertaking, you need to walk into this with your eyes open, because without you, we cannot succeed.
You really caused the deaths of 108 people?
Yes.
Wasn't there an investigation? No charges were filed?
There were certain, unusual circumstances touching on the relationship between Chile and the United States that encouraged both state departments to make sure the investigation was not overly thorough.
I don't like the sound of that.
Glynn turned to Garza. Manuel, will you please give Gideon the necessary background?
Garza nodded, taking a large folder from his briefcase and laying it on the table.
You already know some of this. I'm going to start from the beginning anyway. If you have any questions, feel free to interrupt. 6 years ago, EES was approached by Palmer Lloyd for a peculiar assignment.
The same Palmer Lloyd I just saw in Dearborn Park.
Yes. The billionaire was planning to build a natural history museum in the Hudson River Valley. He was collecting the rarest, finest, and biggest of everything. Money was no object. He had already snagged the biggest diamond, the largest T-Rex, a real Egyptian pyramid. Then, he got a report that the largest meteorite in the world had been found. It lay on Isla Desolacion, an uninhabited island in the Cape Horn Islands at the very tip of South America. The islands belonged to Chile. Lloyd knew that Chile would never allow the meteorite to leave. He therefore hired EES and a meteorite hunter named Sam McFarlane to steal it.
Excuse me, said Glynn. Steal isn't quite the right word. We did nothing illegal. We leased mineral rights to Isla Desolacion, which allowed us to remove iron in any form.
Steal may not be the most apt description, said Garza, but it was a deception.
At this rebuke, Glynn fell silent. Garza continued. The meteorite was extremely heavy, 25,000 tons. It was a deep red color, very dense, and it had other, peculiar properties. So under the cover of this iron ore mining operation, we outfitted a ship, the Rolvag, sailed to the island, excavated the rock, and loaded it on board. Suffice to say, this was a challenging engineering project, but we succeeded. Quite brilliantly, in fact. And then we were caught. A rogue Chilean destroyer captain figured out what we were up to. He commanded the Almirante Ramirez, the ship Lloyd mentioned. Instead of informing his superiors, he decided to play the hero and chased us southward to the ice limit. Ice limit. You've used that term before. What is it exactly? It's the frontier where the southern oceans meet the Antarctic pack ice. We played hide-and-seek among the bergs. The Rolvag was shot up in the confrontation, but ultimately we managed to sink the destroyer.
You sank a destroyer? How?
It's a complicated story, best left to your briefing book. In any case, the Rolvag, carrying the 25,000-ton meteorite in its hold, had been badly damaged by the destroyer. The weather worsened. A point came where we had a choice, either jettison the rock or sink. How do you jettison a 25,000-ton rock? We'd installed a dead man's switch for that purpose, just in case. Throw the switch, and the meteorite would be dropped through a door in the hull.
Wouldn't that founder the ship?
No. A large amount of water would come in before the door could slide shut, but the ship was fitted with pumps and self-sealing bulkheads that would have handled it. The crew and captain wanted to dump the rock. Garza seemed to hesitate, glancing at Glynn.
Tell the full story, Manuel. Spare nothing.
In the end, everyone wanted to dump the rock. Even Lloyd came around. But Eli alone had the code to the dead man's switch. He insisted the ship could ride it out. They begged, pleaded, threatened, and he refused. But Eli was wrong. The Rolvag sank.
Garza glanced at Glynn again. Let me tell the rest, said Glynn quietly. Yes, I refused to pull the switch. I was wrong.
The captain ordered an evacuation. Some got off, but many did not. The captain... He hesitated, temporarily losing his voice. The captain, a woman of great courage, went down with the ship. Many others died in the lifeboats or froze to death on a nearby ice island before help arrived.
And Lloyd? What happened to him?
He was evacuated in the first lifeboat. Against his will, I might add.
How did you survive?
I was in the hold trying to secure the meteorite, but it finally broke out of its cradle and split the ship in half. There was an explosion. It seemed as if the meteorite, when it came into contact with salt water, reacted in an unusual way, generating a shock wave. I was thrown clear of the ship. I remember coming to on a raft of floating debris. I was badly injured. They found me a day later, close to death.
Glynn lapsed into silence, toying with his cup of coffee.
So now the thing's just lying on the seabed. Why all the worry, the talk of danger? And of aliens?
Glynn pushed the coffee cup away.
It was McFarlane, the meteorite hunter, who figured out what it really was.
This was followed by a long silence.
There's a respected theory in astronomy called panspermia, Glynn finally continued. It holds that life may have spread through the galaxy in bacteria or spores, carried on meteorites or in clouds of dust. But that theory assumed microscopic life. Everyone missed the obvious idea that life might be spread by seeds. A gigantic seed would better survive the cold and intense radiation of outer space by its sheer size and resistance. It's the same reason why coconuts are so large, to survive long ocean voyages. The galaxy has many water-covered planets and moons in which such a seed might fall and then sprout.
You're saying this meteorite was actually just such a seed, and when the Rolvag sank, it went to the bottom and was planted?
Yes.
2 miles beneath the surface. And then it sprouted. Gideon shook his head. Incredible. If true. Oh, it's true. It sank roots and grew upward like a giant tree, rapidly. Seismic stations around the world noted a number of shallow quakes on the seafloor at the site. Several small tsunamis raked the coasts of South Georgia and the Falkland Islands. But it was all happening 2 miles deep, and the seismic signature of the quakes looked like the product of undersea volcanic eruptions. So did the mini tsunamis. Since it was in an area far outside of any shipping lanes and posed no risk to anyone, the undersea volcano was generally disregarded. Even volcanologists ignored it, as it was simply too deep and too dangerous to study. And then it went quiescent. All of which explains why nobody figured out what was really going on, except me, of course, and Sam McFarlane, and Palmer Lloyd. He shifted in his chair. But over the past 5 years, we've developed a plan to deal with this problem. Manuel will summarize it for you. Garza looked at Gideon. We're going to kill it. But you said it had gone quiescent. Why go to the trouble and the expense, not to mention the danger? Because it's alien. It's huge. It's dangerous. Just because it's quiescent doesn't mean it will remain so. In fact, our models predict exactly the opposite. Think about it for a moment. What will happen if it blooms or produces more seeds? What if these plants spread to cover the bottom of the oceans? What if they can also grow on land? No matter which way you look at it, this thing's a threat. It could destroy the Earth. So how are you going to kill it? We have in our possession a plutonium core of about 30 kilograms, a neutron trigger device, fast and slow-shaped HE, high-speed transistors, everything needed to assemble a nuke. Where in the hell did you get that stuff? Everything's for sale in certain former satellite states these days. Gideon shook his head. Jesus. We also have a nuclear weapons expert on staff. Who? You, of course. Gideon stared. That's right, said Glenn quietly. Now you know the real reason I hired you in the first place. Because we always knew this day was coming. Chapter 4. The room fell silent. Gideon slowly rose from his chair, making a successful effort to hide his anger. So you hired me to oversee the building of a nuke, he said calmly. Yes. In other words, 4 months ago, back when Garza first walked up to my fishing spot on Chihuahuenos Creek and offered me $100,000 for a week's work, stealing the plans for some new kind of weapon off a defecting Chinese scientist, it was really this moment, this job, that you had in mind? Glenn nodded. And you want to use the nuke to kill a gigantic alien plant that is supposedly growing on the bottom of the ocean. In a nutshell. Forget it. Gideon, said Glenn, we've been through this tiresome dance several times before. Your heated refusals, your storming out, and then your eventual return once you've thought it through. Can we please skip all that? Gideon swallowed, stung by the comment. Let me try to explain to you why this is a crazy idea. Please. First, you can't do this on your own. You need to take this problem to the UN and get the whole world behind the effort to kill this thing. Glenn shook his head sadly. Sometimes you amaze me, Gideon. You seem so smart, and then you say something so remarkably stupid. Did you suggest that we ask the United Nations to solve this problem? Gideon paused. He had to admit, on reflection, that it didn't sound like a very intelligent idea. Okay, maybe not the UN, but at least take it to the US government. Let them deal with it. You mean let our most excellent Congress deal with this situation in the same way it has handled our other pressing national problems, such as global warming, terrorism, education, and our crumbling infrastructure?
Gideon fished around for a snappy rejoinder to this, but could not find one.
"This is no time for waffling," said Glynn. "We're the only ones who can do this. It's got to be done now, while the life form is quiescent. I hope you'll help us.
If not, then, sooner or later, the world as we know it will end. Because without you, we will fail. And you'll reproach yourself for the rest of your life."
"The rest of my short life, you mean? Thanks to what's growing in my own brain. I've got maybe 8-9 months left to live. You and I both know that."
"We don't know that anymore."
Gideon looked at Glynn. His face looked years younger. As he spoke, he gestured with both hands, and his dead eye had healed up and was now clear and deep. His wheelchair was nowhere to be seen. On their last mission together, he had partaken of the restorative, health-giving lotus, just as Gideon himself had. It had worked for Glynn, but not, apparently, for Gideon.
"You really believe you'll fail without me?" Gideon asked.
"I never say anything I don't believe."
"I'll need to be convinced this thing is as dangerous as you say before I help you with anything nuclear."
"You'll be convinced."
Gideon hesitated.
"And you have to make me a co-director of the project."
"That's quite absurd," said Glynn.
"Why? You said we work well as a team, but we've never worked as a team. It's always been you telling me what to do, me doing it my own way, you protesting, and then in the end, I turn out to be right and you're wrong."
"That is an oversimplification," Glynn said.
"I don't want you second-guessing and overruling me, especially if we're dealing with something as dangerous as nuclear weapons. And this seed of yours."
"I don't like governing by committee," Glynn said. "At the least, I'll have to run this through our QBA programs to see if it's feasible."
"You yourself said there's no time," said Gideon. "Make your decision now or I walk. For once, do something without your damn QBA programs."
For a moment, Glynn's face flashed with anger, but then it smoothed out, the neutral mask reasserting itself, until he once again looked like the Glynn of resolute mystery.
"Gideon," he said, "think for a minute about the qualities that a leader, even a co-leader, is required to have. He's a team player. He's good at inspiring others. He's able to hide his true feelings, put up a false front when necessary. He projects confidence at all times, even if he doesn't feel confident. He can't be a freelancer, and he's certainly not a loner. Now tell me, do any of these qualities describe you?"
There was a pause.
"No," Gideon finally admitted.
"Very well."
Glynn rose. "Our first stop is the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and then it's off to the South Atlantic, and beyond the ice limit."
Chapter 5. As the helicopter banked, the afternoon sun shimmered off the waters of Great Harbor, Massachusetts, and the RV Batavia came into view. Gideon was surprised at how big it looked from above, just how much, with its massive prow and tall central superstructure, it dwarfed all the other research vessels and boats in the mooring field.
"A Walter N. Harper class oceanographic research vessel," Glynn said from the adjoining seat, noticing Gideon's interest. 320 feet in length, beam of 58 feet, 21-foot draft. It has 2 3,500-horsepower Z-drives, a 1,400-horsepower azimuthing jet, full dynamic positioning, 250,000-gallon fuel capacity, 18,000-nautical-mile range at a cruising speed of 12 knots.
"You lost me with the part about the azimuthing jet."
"All it means is that the jet drive can be rotated in any horizontal direction, so the ship doesn't need a rudder. It allows for very exact dynamic positioning, even in rough seas with winds and currents."
"Dynamic positioning?"
"Keeping the ship in one place. Gideon, surely you know all about boats after your recent adventure down in the Caribbean?"
"I know I don't like them. I know I don't like being on the sea, and I'm quite content to remain ignorant of all things nautical."
The helicopter finished its turn and began to descend toward the midship's helipad, A deckhand with wands motioned them into place, and a moment later, the door was opened and they hopped out. It was a brilliant fall afternoon, the sky a cold blue dome, the sun slanting across the deck. Gideon followed Manuel Garza and Glynn across the helipad, the EES director crouching a little stiffly against the backwash of the rotors. They went through a door into a waiting and staging room, sparely furnished. Three people immediately stood up, two in uniform and one civilian. Outside, the chopper lifted off.
"Gideon," said Glynn, "I'd like you to meet Captain Tully, master of the RV Batavia, and Chief Officer Leonard."
The captain, a man of no more than 5 feet, stepped forward and shook Gideon's hand with gravity, his tight and humorless face breaking into a poor semblance of a smile. One brisk up-and-down motion, and then he stepped back. Chief Officer Leonard was worlds apart from Tully, a blonde Nordic woman in her early 50s who towered over the diminutive captain, full of warmth and fluid motion, with a hand as warm and as enveloping as an oven mitt. "And this is Alexandra Lispinard, who is in charge of our fleet of 4 DSVs. She'll be your driving instructor." Lispinard tossed her long, teak-colored hair and took his hand with a smile, giving it a slow shake. "Nice to meet you, Gideon," she said, her contralto voice in contrast to the formal silence of the others.
"DSVs?" Gideon asked her, trying not to stare as he did so.
She was about 35 and stunningly attractive, with a heart-shaped face and exotic, agate-colored eyes. "Deep submergence vehicles. A motorized bathyscaphe, really. A marvel of engineering." Gideon felt the pressure of Glynn's hand on his shoulder.
"Ah, here's the doctor. Gideon, I'd like you to meet Dr. Bramble, the expedition's physician."
A wiry old man with a glossy pate, wearing a white lab coat, had appeared in the doorway.
"Pleased, very pleased,"
he said in a wry Irish accent. He did not offer to shake hands.
"Dr. Bramble," said Glynn, "was on the Rolvog when it went down. I'm sure when he has a chance, he'll tell you all about it."
This unexpected statement was greeted by a short silence. The two ships' officers looked surprised and displeased. Gideon wondered if Bramble might be considered a kind of unlucky Jonah.
"That isn't a fact I care to have bandied about," said Bramble shortly.
"My apologies. In any case, Gideon, you've now met several of the most important people on board. Alex will take you down to hangar deck. I'm afraid I have another engagement."
With no further talk, Lispinard turned away, and Gideon followed her through an open bulkhead door, down a circular metal staircase, and along a maze of cramped passageways, stairs, and hatches, until, quite suddenly, they came out into a vast, gleaming space. Along the sides stood several bays, some covered with drop cloths, but 4 of which were open. Inside 3 of these were small, identical rounded vessels, painted bright yellow with turquoise trim. They sported a variety of thick portholes, along with various extruding bulges and projections and a kind of robotic arm set into the bows. The stern wall of the hangar contained a large door, which had been rolled open, exposing the ship's fantail deck. A 4th vessel was visible there, under an A-frame crane. Lispinard began humming Yellow Submarine.
"My sentiments exactly," said Gideon. "Very cute. $20 million worth of cute. That one under the crane is George. The other 3 are Ringo, John, and Paul."
"Oh, no." She walked through the hangar, stepped up to George, and placed her hand on it, giving it a little pat of affection. It was surprisingly small, no more than 9 feet long and about 7 feet high. She turned to Gideon. "Inside there's a titanium personnel sphere, almost a sub within a sub, with a hatch at the top and 3 viewports. There's a panel of electronics, a seat, controls, video screens, and that's about it. Oh, and there's a receiving basket in front for the robot arm to place items in. If something should go wrong, there's an emergency release that jettisons the sphere and sends it to the surface.
The rest of the DSV is taken up with ballast tanks, a mercury trim tank, cameras, strobes and lights, sonar, a bank of batteries, a stern propulsion motor, propellers, and a rudder. Simple. She shrugged. Shakedown dive tomorrow. Gideon turned from George to her. Great. Who's going? She smiled. You and me, 0700.
Wait, you and me? You think I'm going to drive one of those? I'm no Captain Nemo.
They're designed to be driven by anyone. They're idiot-proof.
Thank you very much.
What I mean is, they have self-driving software, like a Google car, but controllable with a joystick. You just move the joystick indicating where you want to go, and the mini-sub's AI does the rest, making all the dozens of little adjustments necessary, avoiding obstacles, maneuvering through tight spaces, doing all the fine control without you even being aware of it. You can't crash it even if you try.
Surely there are other people along for this joyride who have more experience with DSVs.
There are. Antonella Sachs, for example, our exobiology chief. But she won't be joining the ship for some time yet. Besides, Glenn said there was a reason you should get comfortable with operating a DSV. Something to do with your role in the overall mission?
He never mentioned I'd be driving a submarine. I don't like being on the water, let alone in it, and 2 miles down, for Christ's sakes.
She peered at him with a half-smile. That's strange. I didn't take you for a wimp.
I am a wimp. I am most definitely, without doubt, a lily-livered, spineless, cowardly, gutless poltroon.
Poltroon. Nice word. But you're going down with me tomorrow. End of discussion.
Gideon gave her a stare. God, he was sick of bossy women.
But there was no point in arguing with her for the moment. He would take it up with Glenn.
So, what else is there to see around here?
There's the various labs. They're fantastic. You'll see them soon enough. Along with the mission control room, a library, galley, dining room, lounge and game room, and crew quarters. Not to mention the engine room, machine shop, commissary, sick bay, and all the other shipboard necessities. She checked her watch. But now, it's time for dinner.
At 5 o'clock?
When breakfast is at 5:30, all the meal times are shifted.
Breakfast at 5:30?
This was another thing he'd take up with Glenn, this totally unnecessary nod to military discipline.
I hope to God this isn't a dry ship.
Not now. It will be once we arrive on target. We've quite a long journey ahead of us.
How long?
9,000 nautical miles to the target site. It hadn't occurred to Gideon there would be a long preliminary voyage before they even reached their goal. Of course, if he'd given it even a moment's thought, he would have realized. What had Glenn said about the cruising speed of the ship? 12 knots, 12 nautical miles per hour, divided by 9,000 nautical miles. 32 days, said Alex. Gideon groaned. Chapter 6.
Let's take our drinks out on deck, Gideon said to Alex Lispinard.
Good idea.
Gideon rose from the bar, trying to keep his second martini from slopping over the rim. The bar on the RV Batavia, an alcove off the dining room, was small and spare, but pleasing in a kind of nautical way. It sported a row of windows, presently looking over Great Harbor to the low-lying shores of Ram Island. After negotiating the low door, they emerged on deck. It was a faultless October evening. Cool and deep, the golden light falling aslant the ship, the cries of seagulls in the distance. Gideon took a good slug of the drink and leaned on the rail, Alex joining him. He was feeling good. Very good, in fact. A total reversal from how he'd felt just 2 hours before. It was amazing what an excellent meal and a martini could do to one's outlook on life.
Think we're going to get fed like that throughout the voyage? Gideon asked. Oh, yeah. I've been on a lot of research vessels, and the food is always good. When you're months at sea, bad food means bad morale. And on a trip like this, food is the least of any expense, so you might as well stock the best. And in Vince Brancacci, we have one of the finest chefs afloat. You mean that guy I saw in the white smock with the laugh of a hyena and the build of a sumo wrestler? That's the one.
Gideon took another slug and glanced at Alex, leaning on the rail, the breeze stirring her glossy brown hair, her upturned nose and agate eyes aimed at the blue sea horizon, her breasts just pressing into the rail. He averted his eyes. As attractive as she was, there was no way, none, that he was going to get involved in a romance on a long voyage to the antipodes of the world. She turned toward him.
So, what's your history?
You haven't been briefed?
The opposite of briefed. Beyond asking me to familiarize you with the DSVs, Glenn was totally mysterious. I got the sense he wanted me to find everything out for myself.
Gideon was relieved. This meant she knew nothing about his medical situation.
Where to begin? I started my professional career stealing art, then I got a job designing nuclear bombs.
She laughed.
Naturally. It's true. I work at Los Alamos, designing the high-explosive lenses used to implode the cores. I was part of the stockpile stewardship program, running computer simulations and tweaking those lenses to make sure the bombs would still go off after years of rotting in some nuclear vault somewhere. I'm, on extended leave at present.
Wait, you're not kidding?
Gideon shook his head. His drink was disappointingly empty. He thought of going back for a third, but a little voice in his head told him that would not be a good idea.
So you actually design nukes?
More or less. That's why I'm on this voyage, in fact.
What do nuclear bombs have to do with this voyage?
Gideon stared at her. She really hadn't been briefed. He quickly backtracked.
It's just that I'm an engineer with a knowledge of explosives, that's all.
And you weren't kidding about the art thief business, either?
No.
One question. Why?
I was poor. I needed money. And more important, I loved the pieces I stole. And I only stole from historical societies and museums that weren't taking care of their collections. Stuff that nobody saw, anyway.
And I suppose that made it morally okay.
This irritated Gideon.
No, it didn't, and I'm not excusing myself. Just don't expect me to grovel in guilt and self-reproach.
A silence. He really might need that third drink now. Or maybe it was time to change the subject.
I also worked as a magician. Prestidigitator, to be precise.
You were a magician? So was I.
Gideon stood up from the rail. He had heard this many times before. Somebody who learned a few card tricks and then bestowed on themselves the hallowed title of magician.
So you can pull a coin from behind someone's ear?
Alex frowned and said nothing.
Gideon leaned back on the railing, realizing he'd offended her.
I was a professional, he explained. I went on stage, got paid well, I even developed some original tricks. Worked with live animals, rabbits, and the like. I had a great trick with a 6-foot python that would clear out half the audience.
He fiddled with his empty glass.
And I still keep my hand in picking pockets for fun, that sort of thing. It's like playing the violin. You have to keep practicing, or your skills go to hell.
I see.
Turns out magical tricks and art thievery are, in fact, related fields.
I imagine they would be.
Gideon had an idea, a really good idea. This would be amusing. He leaned toward her.
I'm going back in for another. Can I bring you one?
2's my limit, but you go ahead. Bring me a glass of water, if you don't mind.
As he departed, he brushed against her, casually, using the distracting touch to lift the wallet out of her open purse. Tucking it into his pocket with his own wallet, he went back inside and returned to the bar.
Another Hendrix on the rocks with a twist, and a glass of water, please.
He watched as the bartender mixed the martini. Alex suddenly appeared next to him.
Getting a little chilly out there.
To his surprise, and more, she leaned against him.
Warm me up?
He put his arm around her, feeling his heart accelerate.
How's that?
Good. That's fine. I'm warm now, thanks.
She shrugged off his light embrace.
Vaguely disappointed,
He picked up his drink while she took her water, clumsily, spilling a little on herself. Drat. She took a napkin and brushed the water off her blouse. He sipped. So what's your history? I grew up on the coast of Maine. My dad had an oyster farm and I helped him out. I basically grew up on the water. We grew diver oysters, so I got my PADI open water cert when I was 10, PADI wreck diving at 15, nitrox cert at 16, and then I got my certs in cavern, deep diver, ice diver, and the rest. I love the sea and everything under it. Majored in marine biology at USC, went on to get my PhD. In what? The benthic life of the Calypso Deep. That's the deepest part of the Hellenic Trench, 17,000 feet. Where is it exactly? The Mediterranean, west of the Peloponnesian Peninsula. I spent a lot of time on the RV Atlantis over there, dove down on the Alvin. That was the first real DSV, actually. Cruising off Greece. Nice way to get a PhD. I never feel more at home than when I'm on a ship. Funny, because I never feel less at home. The sea makes me sick. Give me the high mountains of the west and a stream full of cutthroat trout any day. You get seasick, I get altitude sickness. Too bad, said Gideon. There goes my marriage proposal. The joke fell flat, and Alex sipped her water in the awkward silence that followed. And the magic thing? Do you still do that? Gideon quickly asked. She waved her hand. I could never compete with you. It was just a little thing I did to amuse myself and my friends. I'd be happy to teach you a few basics. She raised her eyes to him. That would be wonderful. Maybe we should go back to my quarters, if I can locate them, that is. I actually packed a few magic tricks. I'm sure with a little help, you'd pick them up quickly. Let's go. I'll show you the way to crew quarters. He finished his drink, pretended to slap his jeans. Oops, forgot my wallet. Would you mind picking up the tab? I'll get the next one. He watched with a smile of anticipation as she delved into her purse for her wallet, knowing that she'd find it missing. To his vast surprise, she pulled it out and placed it on the bar. Wait, that's your wallet? Of course. She took out a 20 and paid the tab. Gideon reached for his pocket and found her wallet was gone. His wallet was gone as well. Oh, shit, he said automatically. I think I may have dropped something out on the deck. He rose from his stool and immediately fell flat on his face. Stupefied, he looked at his feet, only to find that his shoelaces had been tied together. He glanced up to see Alex laughing hilariously, holding his wallet in her hand, along with his wristwatch. So, Gideon, she said between gusts of laughter, about those basics? Chapter 7. Gideon flushed from embarrassment. God, he felt like an idiot. He untied his shoes while Alex stood over him, not bothering to conceal her triumph. He stood up and dusted himself off. His embarrassment began to turn to something else as she handed him the wallet and wristwatch. You're not angry? She asked, recovering her composure. He looked at her standing there, face aglow, agate eyes twinkling, long glossy hair in unruly coils over her tan shoulders, breasts still heaving from the recent hilarity. Here she'd humiliated him, and what was his reaction? Overwhelming desire. He averted his eyes and swallowed. I guess I deserved it. He glanced at the bartender, but he was inscrutable, as if he'd seen nothing. You still want me to show you the crew quarters? She asked. Sure. She turned and strode out of the bar and through the dining room while he followed. They navigated another maze of corridors and stairs, through a bulkhead hatch, and into a long, narrow corridor with rooms on one side. She stopped at a door and opened it. The scientists have private rooms. This is mine. He followed her in. It was surprisingly spacious, with a queen-size bed, two portholes, built-in dresser, writing table with a laptop computer, mirror, walls painted cream white. Here's the bath. She threw open another door to reveal a small bathroom with a third porthole. Very nice, he said. Quite the room for a, well, a scientist. She turned. I'm not just a mini subdriver. I'm the mission's head oceanographer, as I'm sure you know. I've been with EES for 5 years now. Actually, I didn't know. I haven't really been briefed either. How come I've never met you before? You must know Glynn's mania for compartmentalization. And your position vis-a-vis Garza? He's an engineer. I'm a scientist. EES doesn't have a normal corporate structure, as I'm sure you've realized. Things change from mission to mission. He nodded, watching her move around the room, smoothly and gracefully. She had a swimmer's body, lithe and athletic. He had sworn, absolutely sworn, that he would not get into another romantic entanglement. Given the medical death sentence hanging over his head, it wasn't fair, either to him or to the woman. But that was theoretical. She was real. What's your room number? She asked. 214. That's at the end of the hall. Let's check it out. She headed out the door, and he followed. They went down the hall to the door marked 214. He took out the magnetic keycard he'd been given when being processed earlier in the day, waved it at the lock, and the door clicked. He pushed it open and switched on the light, to be greeted by a luxurious, spacious cabin with a row of portholes, a king-size bed, a sitting area with a sofa and two chairs. The floor was covered in thick cream-colored pile, the lighting soft and indirect. His luggage had already been placed in one corner, neatly arranged. Wow, said Alex, stepping inside. And what's your position at EES to merit all this? I don't know. Slacker in chief? He followed her in and watched as she took a turn around the room, her hand stroking the quilted bed covers, adjusting the lights. She opened the door to the bathroom. A tub, no less. Making herself quite at home, she next explored the sitting area, where there was a kitchen nook with a microwave oven, coffee machine, and small fridge. She opened the fridge. And look! Veuve Clicquot! She took out a split of champagne and waved it at him. Great! Let's open it and celebrate. She put it back, shut the fridge door firmly. Two's my limit, remember? And you're already over yours. I need you clear-headed for tomorrow's dive. And besides, I don't drink champagne in strange men's rooms. Me? A strange man? Art thief, nuke designer, magician? Very strange. We'll enjoy it tomorrow evening, then. You and me. We'll be wiped out after our shakedown dive. She glanced at her watch. In fact, I better be getting back to my quarters. I got a lot of work to do before bedtime. He walked up to her and put his hand on her shoulder as she turned to go. What was he doing? He knew that third drink was a mistake, but he wasn't going to stop now. He felt his whole body aching with longing. She paused at his touch, and he leaned toward her. But then she deftly ducked out from under his hand and stepped aside. None of that, mister. Not on a ship. You know better. I wish I did know better. Breakfast at 05:30, remember. Then we go to the DSV hangar and prep. See you then. And she was gone. He sat down on the bed with a sigh. He also had a ton of work to do. Files and documents to review, a computer to set up and get networked into the ship's system. And he couldn't go to Glynn and argue himself out of the dive, not after three martinis, smelling like a drunk. He stretched out on the bed, hands behind his head. Alex's faint perfume remained in the air, and he inhaled it, feeling another surge of longing. What was wrong with him? He should be pissed off at the way she'd humiliated him, but instead it seemed to be having an altogether different effect. Alex, he decided, was right about one thing. He had better get himself under control, or this was going to be a very long voyage indeed. Chapter 8. A big autumn sun rose over the distant Nobska Lighthouse and Vineyard Sound, casting gold across the water as they came out on deck early the next morning. A stiff breeze blew in from the east, kicking up whitecaps across the harbor and the sound beyond. The A-frame crane had moved two DSVs out of the hangar deck and onto the fantail. To Gideon, they looked stubby, even cartoonish, almost too small to fit a human inside, let alone everything else. Alex had told him to wear tight-fitting but warm clothing. She was dressed in a sleek tracksuit of dark blue with white racing stripes, which hugged her muscled legs, rear, and torso in a way Gideon found most distracting. He, on the other hand, was dressed like a slob in jeans and a long-sleeved undershirt. Glynn and Garza were standing together when they arrived. Glynn was dressed in a black turtleneck and pants, a thin, even spectral figure on the windswept deck. Garza wore a suede jacket with the collar turned up, his salt-and-pepper hair stirred by the wind.
"Right on time," said Glynn,
approvingly, coming over with an outstretched hand and giving Gideon a shake. Not exactly firm, but with no more clutching awkwardly at claw-like fingers.
"Are you ready to go deep, Gideon?
I wish you told me I was going to be piloting a yellow submarine."
"To what end? It only would have worried you. These DSVs are idiot-proof."
"So Alex tells me."
"She's an excellent instructor. You'll do fine."
"But I thought my job was to be your expert on nuclear explosives. Surely you could have hired an extra sub-driver." Instead of answering, Glynn patted him on the shoulder in a way that Gideon found patronizing. Gideon glanced at Garza for an explanation, but the engineer was, as usual, silent and unreadable.
"You'll be driving George, and I'll be in Ringo," Alex told him.
While Glynn and Garza watched, Alex gave him an external tour of George, pointing out and naming the various parts. Cameras, strobes, viewing ports, CTFM sonar, sail lights, current meter sensor, emergency identification strobe, emergency homing radio, lift propellers, rudder and ram propeller, underwater telephone transducer, collecting basket, and robot arm. "The ladder goes up to the sail hatch," she explained. "It's pretty simple. Just climb up and lower yourself inside using the two grab bars. The personnel sphere is 5 feet in diameter. I'll get into Ringo and we'll communicate through radio, do a dry run on deck, and then get lowered into the water."
"Should I climb up now?"
She nodded. "Just lower yourself into the chair. On a hook just above your head, you'll find the communications helmet. Put that on and toggle the switch on the lower right. Wait for me to talk. You don't have to press a transmit button. It's full duplex above water. Underwater, the range of actual conversation is limited to 500 meters. Beyond that, there's only communication.